You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our right-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. James E. Hayden, President and Chief Executive Officer of Martha Jefferson Health Services, was the featured speaker at the February 11th meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. James Hayden was named President and CEO of Martha Jefferson Health Services in 1993. Mr. Hayden received his master's degree in public health and health services management from UCLA in 1971. He completed his administrative residency at Scripps Hospital in La Jolla, California, and received the 1988 Alumni of the Year Award from the UCLA Health Services Management Alumni Association. Mr. Hayden served as president and CEO of Queen of the Valley Health Services in West Covina, California, from 1986 to 1993. Prior to that, he served as chief operating officer of Hoag Memorial Hospital Presbyterian in Newport Beach, California, from 1978 to 1986. Mr. Hayden has served as associate administrator at Huntington Memorial Hospital in Pasadena, California, from 1976 to 1978. In 1992, Mr. Hayden was chairperson of the California Association of Catholic Hospitals and was a member of the Hospital Council of Southern California from 1988 to 1993. Our podcast is entitled Martha Jefferson Hospital, The Old and the New. SSV Treasurer Bill Hodson moderated today's program.
Our speaker today had a successful career in California before joining us here in Virginia as CEO and president of Martha Jefferson Hospital. It came to us in 1993, and we Virginians were most happy to get him because throughout his tenure here, he has been involved in community builder, and we thank him for that. Jim has received numerous community awards and participated in leadership roles in the United Way, the Piedmont Community College, Chamber of Commerce, and if you want to go more in detail, look at the announcement. That gets everything, but we won't do that right now. Presently, Mr. Hayden is active in the United Way, where he chairs two important committees there, and Smart Beginning Leadership Council, which is a group that are searching for ways to begin educating our younger people, preschool and so forth. And but professionally, Mr. Hayden has led Martha Jefferson Hospital into bringing it to be listed as one of the 100 best hospitals in the country, community hospitals in the country. And just recently, they were ranked in the top 5% of hospitals in the country in patient satisfaction, stroke care, OBGYN, and safety. And that is a mark that sort of goes along with the other great things that the hospital has done under Mr. Hayden's leadership. He's going to talk today about Martha Jefferson, old and the new. And if any of you have been to the new outpatient clinic over on Pantops, you know that we can expect quality in the new hospital and look forward to a great future. Please join me in welcoming Jim Hayden. Jim?
Thank you very much. Bill, thank you for that very nice introduction. First, I want to congratulate all of you and what you do as in your senior statesman's group, because I know you have candidates and what's happening in this area, and you contribute to the comments and the discussion that make our community better. So I would encourage you to continue to do that, and I want to say that I appreciate you doing that. And two things I want to say about Marvin. Here's my dues for next year. I probably will miss a lot of your meetings, but I love them. I know you had Ed Burton here recently, and your next speaker sounds great. I hope that's somewhere in the middle of this sandwich. Here it is. All right. Okay, done. Good. So I'm safe for 2009 at least, and I will try to make a few of these meetings. Well, thank you very much. The other thing I might mention about Marvin, at Martha Jefferson Hospital, you know, I get a lot of credit, and I'm just part of a big, big team that does a lot of different things, and I really get way, way too much credit. But one individual that's related to Marvin, I believe it's your son-in-law, Mike Matthews, is what we call our owner's representative for this project that I'm going to show you in just a moment. And Mike is that fellow that talks the language of the Mortenson construction people and the architects better than I do and my staff, because we've learned to run hospitals, perhaps, but not build multi-million-dollar new hospitals. And so Mike Matthews, if you really want a good speaker sometime with some really great slides, you know, you should ask Mike Matthews. And his will be a little bit different than mine, but he has to report not only to myself and others but also to the Finance Committee of the Board of Trustees every so often. And every time he leaves, he usually makes a presentation at the beginning and leaves because we have other business. And several members of the Board Finance Committee say, wow, is he good? And he really is, Marvin. So we won't say that in front of him, but, you know, I just wanted you to know that. What I'm going to show you today, I've been asked to talk about the replacement hospital that we're building. I'm sure most of you know about that. And then a little bit at the end towards what we're going to do with the hospital that exists downtown at 459 Locust Avenue. But before I run through a building project, and it's always interesting and fun to do so and to talk about it, but the most important thing at a hospital is what happens inside. And I want to assure you that we are working every bit as hard to improve our programs, to increase the quality of care and safety and the rest that go on at Martha Jefferson Hospital. Now, those things aren't necessarily as apparent as big buildings. They're not as easy to measure as what the Finance Committee measures. But we have wonderful people working very, very hard on that from the community, as well as doctors and nurses and administrators. So I did put one slide in there that reflects that sometime. But perhaps if you found it worthwhile, we'd be happy to have one of our clinical people, doctors or chief nurse executive, come and talk about where we're good and where we need to get better. Just recently, this last Saturday, we had a board retreat at the Outpatient Care Center for the morning, and it had to do nothing but with safety. And we were reflecting back that this is nothing new. Over the last 18 months, we actually had an outside organization do a medical audit. You know, we have obviously audits that come in, you know, every year by, you know, one of the accounting firms, and they take 3 or 4 months, go through the books, check everything, check your controls, so on and so forth. Well, one of our board members said, you know, we ought to bring someone from the outside to do a medical audit for us. And we did. We brought a large healthcare organization that doesn't exist in this particular neighborhood and said, you know, go through our books, if you will, look at us, and tell us good, bad, and indifferent. And that started that discussion. Thank goodness we were pretty good. There were things we could get better. And when some of the doctors saw, oh, we're not as good as where we would like to be in certain areas, boy, they hustled out and said, we got to get better, and we've been getting better in those. Then we brought in a speaker by the name of Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill was the chairman and CEO of Alcoa and was a secretary of treasurer for 2 years under the George Bush. Very outspoken fellow. Has a lot of, because one of our board members worked with Paul O'Neill, and he had a little saying about Paul. Has a lot of saying about Paul. Paul will get you the promised land, but it's a rough, rough ride, and not everybody stays on board. But, you know, Paul O'Neill came up, and he talked about safety, and he talked about, you know, a worldwide organization that he had and all the people all over the world. And when he asked his risk management on safety, how are they doing for the employees, someone brought him numbers. He said, well, these numbers are good, but I want to know the people. I want to see people and what happened to them. I may never know John Jones in Indiana or in South America, but let's turn these numbers into people. And so there were some excellent lessons from that individual. We brought a Dr. David Nash from the Jefferson Health System up in the Philadelphia area. And it's about, he's the medical director for the entire system. They have 6 or 7 hospitals. And he talked about, dealing with physicians. He talked about himself being a patient and kind of what worked and what didn't work in his own system and the lessons learned. So we have, and then this past Saturday, our speaker was someone from had a background in safety in the nuclear regulatory arena. A fabulous speaker on safety, and he's converted now as a consultant in talking about safety in hospitals as well. Again, I just mention this because it's so easy just to talk about buildings and views and, you know, lobbies and, you know, emergency rooms and so on and so forth, which are darn important to us. But the most important thing, again, is you know, what happens inside those particular rooms. So with that background, I'm going to go through this. I will try to talk quickly so none of you fall asleep. Let's see here. Well, okay, some people say, well, why even bother having a new hospital? You have a, you know, a facility downtown, and, you know, if we said that in 1916 with the first hospital, you would say, oh, well, I see why you need a new hospital. 1929, that building is on the corner of Locust Avenue and High Street, still exists. My office is in there, a lot of offices. It was the replacement hospital, and it was on the it's on the corner, like I said, and when that was finished, the Patterson family was nice enough to gave the hospital $100,000 to build the replacement hospital. And, of course, at that time said it's on 9 acres of land. It's all the land we will ever need. There it is. Well, that was great in 1929, but our codes today don't even allow us to use it as a hospital. We only can use it for offices. The next building picture is an aerial picture of the campus as it is today. And then on just a picture in 2003 of our outpatient care center at Pantops. Are many of you familiar with that building? Most of you know where that is? Okay. Just quickly, our vision statement is to set the standard for clinical quality in personal health care. Again, I mention this because we don't want people to say about Martha Jefferson Hospital, oh my gosh, they're just so darn nice down there. I mean, we do want them to say that, but not at the expense of being really good at clinical care. You know, if we can't do something, if we can't benchmark ourselves against the University of Virginia Medical Center or anywhere else where they do a particular service, then we shouldn't be doing it at all. So we want to have both. On the other hand, we don't want to be just clinically real good and not be have high personal care, because we think that's a very important point of important item of getting health care. And these are some of the ways that we talk about how we should fulfill that mission and vision. This, again, is that aerial view a little bit closer up on our current site. And as you can tell, there's really no room to grow on that particular site. We're landlocked. It's been a wonderful campus for over 100 years. The neighbors there understandably don't want us to increase and encroach on their nice neighborhood. So when we did a strategic plan in the year roughly 2000, 2001, it was determined if we were going to have another 100 years serving the community, we would have to find another location. We looked at many locations, and we thought for a lot of considerations that the Pantops location would be the best place for us to go. These are some of the things that really in the last few years that we've added to what Martha Jefferson Hospital does and can do. And I won't read this list, but there are a lot of things that, you know, it's not just more office space, but several years ago we didn't have wound care, we didn't have retina surgery, we have reproductive medicine, which is actually out in the Pantops location, you know, currently, the things that we do in cancer, things that we can do in heart, we didn't have spine surgeon, it's a lot of those things have occurred really in the last 5 to 6, 7 years. They continue to grow. So some of the needs were, you know, to attract new physicians and nurses and employees, to provide advanced technology capabilities. Where do we put these things in the current location? Well, we can't provide private patient rooms. At Martha Jefferson currently, 50% of our rooms are semi-private. And when that's in one particular tower, and when that tower was built, people said, is this great? No more wards. This is wonderful. Semi-private rooms. Well, today when someone lands in a semi-private, you know, I get a call, Ray Mishra gets a call, nursing gets a call, L.A. Quita gets a call. Gee, can't you get me into a private room? So it's just people want different things, and it has actually been shown that it's better for, not spreading infections and the like if we can keep people in their private rooms. So we will have 100% of our rooms will be private patient rooms. Expand square footage for clinical program development and future growth. At Pantops, I think most of you said you know where this is. Pantops is a business park consisting of over 240 acres. We have purchased 88 acres. It has easy access from 64. You can go down across 250 State Farm. We understand that, and when we looked at this, we knew that wherever we chose to go, there was going to be traffic. And there is traffic there. We have, committed, hundreds of thousands of dollars to help do our share in traffic improvement in that particular area. And we always said that we'd be happy to do our share, but a lot of other things that are growing up there, and those individuals and organizations ought to help as well. That's the outpatient care center that exists currently. It's about 4.5 years old, and when we started this building, it was going to be 30,000 square feet. Well, it's over 90,000 square feet, and we're out of room there. We just converted the urgent care center that exists up there into a freestanding emergency department, and we have one downtown as well. In planning a new hospital, there was the getting educated, there was building a team, was getting organized, and the start of construction. And I want to talk a little bit about each of those. Under getting educated, these are some of the things that we did. One of the great things about, hospitals all across this country, and certainly in Virginia, they would share not only when they would build a new hospital, the things that went right, but probably more importantly, the things that didn't go right, the unintended consequences. And so we have visited many of those hospitals. Different teams would visit different hospitals. Nurses and doctors who work in the emergency department would visit new emergency departments, find out what works well and what doesn't work well. We did a lot of reading. We had speakers come in. There was the architects who are helping us. They're a group from the Wisconsin area who did a terrific job at the outpatient care center. They, of course, who have done many, many hospitals, gave us their ideas and, again, what they thought worked well and what wouldn't work well. And we filtered this, of course, through our own vision and what we wanted to create and, of course, to reflect our own community as well. Building a team. One of the things that we learned early on, people said, get the whole team together early. Granted that you don't need some of the expertise until much later, but it would be a lot better to have those individuals who you would add later, for instance, the general contractor, early on talking with the architect. So if they were going to disagree, they could disagree when it cost you relatively a small amount of money, not much later on when it's going to cost you a lot of money. So we did that. And, again, we heard that over and over and over, and we assembled this whole team at one time. A lot of different people on the team, and we're very, very happy with the team that's been assembled. On the internal processes and teams, I'll talk about that in just a moment. So, again, in building the team, we had a vision. We wanted motivation. We wanted a lot of compatibility. We wanted, people, again, that had expertise that we didn't have. But we wanted them to have, if you will, a Martha Jefferson fit, a Charlottesville fit. And so all of these things that you see up here, kind of went into consideration and putting our team together. These are just some of the individuals that are helping us, everything from financing to building to designing it as well. And I got to tell you, I've learned a lot of things that I didn't even know, existed. We've got some consultants that I never thought of. I never knew anything. There are consultants that... So that all these electronic devices, I don't mean the bigger ones, but the smaller ones, the gates go up, for parking, the phone systems and all of those sorts of things, so they don't interfere with one another. There's hundreds of the nurse call systems, and those are always changing, the phone systems. So it's been quite a learning process. I'm not going to go through this. If Mike Matthews were here, he could speak for the 45 minutes just on this alone. But again, when we were getting organized in the first 14 months, we said were so important. There were two tracks that we felt we had to go down. We had to build this hospital from the inside out. And early on, in the fundraising aspect, poor Ray Mischer would love to have had some pretty pictures. But we said, we need to design it as a hospital first and decide what it looks like later on. And so we spent a lot of time, if you will, from the inside out, and then later on from kind of outside in design. And there were two filters that it always had to go through. It had to go through an affordability. It couldn't be just something that, we love so much. You do all these things, but we couldn't afford it. And then the approvability. There's a lot of approvals that you have to go through. You have to go through approval with the state called Certificate of Public Need. I know that Gene Davis knows about that one well, and some of the rest of you do also. There's the local zoning and planning and site reviews with the county that had to go through. So we needed to put it through these screens, always of affordability and approvability, and we're still doing that. We'll probably do that until the day we open. I'm not going to read all this to you, but one of the things that I think was a little bit different on this particular model that we chose to do, and it was in part for a lot of reasons. One is who we are. It's also the architectural firm and their particular culture. But we knew that if you look on the right side, that you're going to get doctors and nurses and the like to help you with designing operating rooms, the emergency rooms, the radiology suites, the patient rooms, so on and so forth. And that's fine and great in the way it should be, but there's other things that you need to consider, such as what should the patient family experience be like, you know, and registration that goes through. Those are important elements, and those, if you will, might be the softer elements. Those might be the highly personalized care elements. When we spent a lot of time, and we brought in a lot of people from the community. We had something like 37 teams, half of which were clinical in nature and half of which are these, you know, the patient nursing care. And we listened to people's stories, and they told us about good experiences and bad experiences that they had at Martha Jefferson Hospital and hospitals, you know, from where they came or where they visited, good things about them as well. And not that we'll do everything right, but we heard so many stories. It was all those little things that, okay, you can take that into consideration and perhaps build that into your hospital. That if you hadn't heard, you wouldn't have thought of that. And again, I'm sure we'll leave certain things out. I'm sure we won't get everything correct. But I do know by going through this very lengthy process that we will have done some things much better than if we just let the architects build this building, which would have been a nice new hospital, but wouldn't be as good without the input of people telling us, this is the way it should be. And without going into a lot of, well, I'll tell you one. A woman who'd been a cancer patient at another hospital said, I understand, and, you know, had surgery and was having radiation therapy treatment and chemotherapy. She, as an inpatient, said, you know, I know nurses, what they do is so important, and they need to be able to pop their popcorn and get their pizzas. But because I was having this chemotherapy this time, I was just nauseous. And when I would have those smells would come in, you know, to the into my room, it'd make me sick. And she said, so we need to have great conference rooms for the nurses. We need to have a better filter system, taking the air out, whatever it is. And it was just interesting because it was a patient, you know. Another individual said to us that when their wife came in and sat down in his doctor's office, she was on a table. And it was really for a discussion. It wasn't for an exam or anything. And it was just awkward. He said there needs to be enough chairs where people can sit and look, you know, eye level to eye level in a room. So it was a lot of those sort of things that make the difference. Oh, this is a patient room. We have built in our basement of the current hospital mock patient rooms. There was two of them to start with, and you know, this is another debate: should the restroom facilities be in the front of the room or the back of the room? And believe it or not, there's good reasons for both. And we needed to debate it. There's excellent reasons for both, and so we built these rooms and we tried them out and we tried. For instance, when my wife was a patient at the hospital 6 months ago, she was in she's coming back from surgery. I'm sitting in this room waiting for her, and when the nurses and orderlies were bringing her up to take her from the gurney from surgery to put her in the patient bed, one poor nurse has to step on a chair to get over to the other side of the bed. So when the patient is in the bed, there's plenty of room. But transporting a patient into the room with two beds now and a couple nurses and make these maneuvers, you go, oh, my gosh, you know. So we built these rooms so that the nurses could, you know, try all sorts of different operations of bringing patients on gurneys and wheelchairs and the like. And, you know, where, and we have different zones. We have a family zone, a patient zone, and a caregiver zone. And we are now down to one room where we've decided that the bathroom should be in the front. We've decided where these different zones should be. Now the hardest part is what color should the walls be? And that one, I know we're not going to make people happy. On one of these mock rooms, we have painted this wall at least 20 different times. So I know that one's going to be the toughest decision. So, but that's kind of, you know, how we've been going at this hospital, building this new hospital. These I won't go into, but again, Mike Matthews would do a great job. When we were explaining these, when we were looking at the particular site, after we chose the site, which is only, you know, 2 miles away from the existing hospital and from, you know, downtown Charlottesville, we wanted to stay close. we little did a ultrasound of the land to find out where the rock was, so that we could place the hospital. And not, we did do some blasting of rock, but minimizing that, you know, and you know how the soil and the water and the runoff and the wind and so on and so forth. Very, very technical stuff that I'm glad there's people out there that know that, because I don't. But yeah, it was a very thorough site analysis. This was our visioning process, you know, for the site itself, you know, built into nature, not on top of it. And what do I mean for that? What's a good example? Well, from the day, actually, before we purchased the property, at that time, Carol Hurt was our board chair, and she and I went up to see Dan Jordan at Monticello. And we said, Dan, you know, we're thinking of buying the property down here and building a, you know, building our replacement hospital. What do you think? He said, well, you know, I'm going to have, we know we're going to have a neighbor sometime. We think Martha Jefferson would probably be an excellent neighbor. We said, we would like you to, you know, put someone on your staff to be with us. This is before the outpatient care center was built. And he did, Mike Merriman, and made a variety of, you know, a host of meetings, you know. And when it came down to siting this building, one of the options we had was to build into, because the land drops from the outpatient care center to State Farm, 97 feet, we were able to build into the side of a hill so that this building won't tower up over everything out there. And Monticello won't be able to see it, and so on and so forth. And we thought that's a good idea, because part of what Martha Jefferson wants to retain is, even though we're going to be in a much bigger building, we want it to feel small in its presence. So by building into the hill, we used something like 38% less of the land. And I'll show you an example later. So we'll have an upper park and a lower park. It won't be, you know, on top of a hill, you know, just standing out there more than it should. The create a hospital in the park, I've mentioned that to you before. The architects, again, it was a great example. When I said, gee whiz, you know, park, why don't I get out there and probably do some fundraising? People like that. He said, well, Jim, if you do that too soon, if you get that park designed too soon before we design the hospital, you might have a great park sitting next to a great hospital, but they really won't be integrated. You know, they really be ought to be together. So there, you know, I listened to the architects, which I'm glad I did, and we're going to have a hospital that's in a park. Create a campus of several small buildings joined together. We wanted, again, to have this feel of small, human-scale friendliness, easy to get around. We wanted to create, you know, order and clarity, create warm and inviting environments, be environmental friendly and natural, create a simple, clean, effective design, build with high level of craft with rich details. It depends how expensive those rich details come before them. But create a simple, clean, effective design. When I show you a picture, if you haven't already seen what the new house would look like, that, like the paint color, was, you know, very not questionable, but there's a lot of debate. You know, some people wanted a nice glass, iconic box. Other people wanted a lot more bricks and white columns. Other people said, we have enough bricks and white columns in this community. Show me something that doesn't have any bricks. The architects bring something back. And this same individual, a great board member, I won't mention his name, but he says, that's a great-looking building, but it should be on the campus of Stanford. I said, you told the architects to bring something back without any bricks. That's all I do. We didn't choose that. But everybody, you know, it's kind of personal taste, just like colors are. So those were kind of the visioning process for the site and what we wanted to do with the site. Okay, this is an aerial view. I'm going to walk over here and show you. What you see in blue is what we're going to be building in our building right now. The other buildings are not built, but the county wanted to see if this is completely built out over the next 50 or 70 years, what would it look like? You can just get an idea how big the project is, because these trucks, I took a picture of some people next to them yesterday, you know, the wheels and tires of them are, you know, over my head. So if you look at those trucks on the side of that hill, you get a feeling of how big that hole is. And there's that loop road that I told you that goes out right. It's actually, it curves out. It's going to really one of the more pleasant drives, I think, in Charlottesville when it's finished. There's an aerial picture of the hole. And there we are. We are 3% complete. The hospital is now 3% finished. I want to officially announce that today. And so 97% more to go. Yeah, it's another aerial view. This is Those are the elevator towers, of course, and what's being built down there is the basement. Now, this is a picture from State Farm. This is the backside of the hospital. When you come down South Pantops, this is what you would see. You would also see a lot of land in front of this. This it doesn't show the entire park area, but what we call the lower park. There'll be a lower park and an upper park. When we were designing this building, again, if you remember, we told the architects we wanted it to be small and human scale and friendly and not dominating and so on and so forth. Well, the first renderings they drew, they brought back, one of my colleagues, some of you know Ron Cottrell, said, and it was not this picture, said, that's nice, but, and he was always pushing this notion of human scale. He said, my gosh, there's no institutional presence. And someone else said, it looks like a high school built in the 60s, you know, but from the backside, it does look larger because, again, it's built into the hill, and you're going to see all five stories. From the front side, you will only see two stories. I'll show you that picture in just a moment. Again, we decided to go with brick, stone, and some hardy plank type of wood, three basic, you know, materials. This is the front door or the entry lobby, if you will. And this building took a lot of time to discuss. Again, like I said, some people wanted this modernistic glass building that would glow at night. Other people wanted it to be very, very traditional. Some people said, actually the representative from Monticello said, why would you do that? They were building their visitor center during this time. We wouldn't build a building that would compete with ourselves, and nor should you. But we were concerned that this building, over the time, to the right of it, is a much larger building. It doesn't look larger. That's a medical office building, the Phillips Cancer Center, and someday there'll be another medical office building to the left of it, and behind it someday parking structures. So this building could easily get dwarfed, and it's your front door. But again, if we want to make clarity, know where you go, where's the front door, how do we do that? Someone came up with the idea of, why don't we put a roof on this building? And, I think the roof will make all the difference so that when people are driving up, they know where they're going, because all of our homes, the smallest part of the home probably is the front door, but you know that's where to go. So that's how we're going to, mark this building. This is the only building that has a roof like that. The others are flat roofs. One of the other things is one of our doctors, some of you may know David Morris, who's involved in one of these particular meetings, and he was talking about, let's be sure that we make space for our caregivers. You know, it's tough work being a nurse and so on and so forth. Let's not leave them out. And you might think a doctor would just talk about the doctors or patients, and certainly David is concerned about both of those, but he was also concerned about the caregivers who work so hard and they're all day and so on and so forth. Right now I'm going to go to the current hospital transition, because people are beginning to ask me about this as much as they're asking me about the new replacement hospital. What's going to happen to the existing hospital? Well, we've started over 24 months ago meeting with at least two dozen private and public groups that had interesting ideas of what it might become. And we had representatives of 20 development companies come tour the site, go out on the roof, and if you go up on the seventh floor or the sixth floor in the hospital, you realize what great views there really are in that existing location. I can say that the economic downturn really has also reduced the number of people who are able to bid on this. A lot of good companies, ones that we are very, very excited about, have projects elsewhere, and because they aren't selling as fast, their absorption rate is slower, it has affected this. But we have three solid players now, and we put out requests for these qualifications. And while we haven't started negotiations, you know, we have been looking through their proposals, trying to get a better idea of what they mean over what period of time. And so we think by the end of 2009, we will have that in place. But we haven't finished. Again, what do I think? People said, what about a nursing home? What about turning it into what they call new urbanism, which is some retail and some condominiums and the like? So there's lots of different ideas, and I think these three different groups have, all three have different ideas. So we're still going to, we'll have to sort through that, then we'll have to negotiate that, and then we'll be talking with the Neighborhood Association on that. We'll talk with the city as we have for the last 2.5 years. So that's where we are in the existing hospital. I'm going to stop and be happy to answer any questions, Bill.
I have a question relating to the existing outpatient facility. You had an arrangement where you made a distinction between urgent care and emergency, and I thought that was a splendid idea. Yeah. Why was it abandoned?
The comment was that the main hospital has a regular emergency room. At the outpatient care center, for some time, we had an urgent care center. So there was this distinction between the two. In the last 6 months or so, the urgent care center at Pantops has turned into a freestanding emergency department. The question was, why did we change? Well, when we, two things happened. In the main hospital, we expanded our emergency department because we knew it'd be 4 or 5 years before we moved, and we opened the urgent care center to decompress what was happening downtown, to take some of the things that really were not true emergencies and could be handled, thinking that that would relieve the pressure of what was happening at the main hospital. Well, we went from the urgent care center from the first year seeing roughly 3,000 patients to the third year, 17,000 patients. And the main emergency department was still increasing its numbers. And so more and more serious patients were coming to the outpatient care center, and we said, and we're using the same group of emergency room physicians, and this is something that there's happening across the country. More and more people are having freestanding emergency departments. We visited the Wake Forest freestanding. They call them FREDS, freestanding emergency department. It's Wake Med, and they do a great job. We visited one in Maryland. I can't remember its name. Innova Northern Healthcare Hospital System has one that we visited. Sentara Hospital System on the Eastern Shore has one. We felt that, you know, we could do this very, very well. It has limited hours. You know, it's from 10 in the morning to 8 at night. But the demand was such, the people who are showing up there are more emergency-oriented, and we felt that we needed to be able to do that. When the new hospital gets built, we will no longer be downtown. That freestanding emergency department will be closed and be moved in, be housed in the main hospital.
I have three quick questions. Number one, are you affiliated formally or informally with the University of Virginia Medical Center? And number two, does your hospital have electronic instant access to studies that may have been done recently at the University of Virginia? And number three, does Martha Jefferson use hospitalists?
All right. Everybody hear the questions. First was, are we formally or informally associated with the University of Virginia Medical Center? The short answer is no, we are not formally associated with the University of Virginia Medical Center. We're very lucky in this community to have both a major medical center and, I think, a superb community hospital. The university, as you know, has its mission is three things. It's teaching, research, and clinical. Martha Jefferson's is just clinical. And we're, again, lucky to have both of them. But I can tell you that there are meetings roughly quarterly. There's one scheduled for this month where myself, my counterpart at UVA, along with physicians meet and talk and see where we might be able to do things together. Sometimes we can and sometimes we can't. As far as do we have access to the research and to the works that they do at the medical center? Yes, we do. They, as a public institution, share that. They should share that. We take advantage of that. We also take advantage of the information that's coming from the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic. We have physicians on our staff from both of those places. We have physicians on our staff from Dartmouth, UCLA, Stanford, and the like. So wherever we can get good information and use it, we do. The question is not electronically instantly. Now, I'm not exactly sure what you would describe as instantly. You know, when papers are published and information is published, it goes through a long process. And once it's accepted, you can Google almost anything and get it. But if you're talking about for instance, patient information going back and forth, that's one of those great questions that's being discussed right now with the Obama health plan, and you can make a case for it or against it. Let me just say that one of the things that we suffer as Americans in the healthcare system is this non-portability of health information. It's criminal. And no matter where you stand on the aisle on this, I think there is a role for government. I think the government should say, you need to have one language. You know, for instance, if any of us today went to San Francisco tomorrow, we go to some bank using our own ATM card, put it in there, and you'd get two things. You'd get your $20, and you know how much balance you have. It's the same language. So these banks, compete on service and price and all of those sort of things. I think that all of these electronic information systems could still compete on price and service and offerings, but they ought to be on the same language. And until they are on that same language, when people don't have the same computers, they're not interfaced, so you cannot get it, instantly. The third question was hospitalists. Do we have hospitalists? Does everyone know what hospitalists are? Okay, I'm going to assume that there's one person in the room that may not know what hospitalists are. Martha Jefferson does have hospitalists. Hospitalists, in our case, are board-certified internists who are in the hospital 24 hours a day to cover, to accept a patient from your physician, primary care physician or specialist. So it's one of those also things that people have to get used to, because it might not be the doctor that you all like so much that doesn't follow you to the hospital, but this doctor is at the hospital, and that doctor, he or she, can run to the lab, run to the x-ray, because they don't have an office full of patients. And they can, see what's happening in the lab. They can see what's happening in radiology or the like. So they can really stay on your case much better. It'd be like having a fully trained residents or fellows, because these doctors have already graduated. Now, for instance, some of our physicians, we do not tell our primary care physicians that you have to use the hospitalist. They can use the hospitalist or not use the hospitalist. So there's plenty of choice in that. So you can choose a physician that he or she wants to use hospitalist or not. And I've gotten calls from someone who was not recently who said, it was someone I didn't know, had been a patient at Martha Jefferson Hospital twice in the last 6 or 7 months, and said, most recently, when I was in the hospital, my own doctor came to see me. I love my own doctor, but my own doctor only came once a day. The time before, when my own doctors turned me over to hospitalists, I saw the hospitalist 2 or 3 times. I said, you need to talk to your own doctor about that. So
I would like to just comment on that, because when my husband was there, 3 different times we had hospitalists, and they endeared themselves to me.
Oh, good.
I know their names.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I know it takes some getting used to, because if you had a primary care physician all your life and you expected that primary care doctor to come and visit you, that was nice, but it would be early in the morning, might not be awake, or late at night if he or she were in their office, they weren't going to be around as much. So I do think it's a wonderful service, but it's different. And it's
impressed me as being competent and compassionate.
Good. I'm glad to hear. You know what? I can tell you, they are competent, and I think they are compassionate. If you have a long, long stay, you may end up with a couple of different hospitalists, because they can't be there, 48 hours. You don't want them there 2 nights in a row staying up late either. But I'm glad to hear that, and I think most people feel just the way you do.
Like, I had to comment on that since it was brought up. But my real reason for asking for this opportunity, I had reason to have access to the drawings a year or so ago. There were 2 areas that really excited me.
Okay, what were those?
One was your having the OR recovery, interventional radiology, things that you don't need an elevator. And if you need to rapidly move the patient from one area to another, you're all right there together.
Good for you.
So that was one.
Okay.
Now I have to comment on the second one.
All right.
When I saw where you have a dedicated area for family members to stay around the clock if they feel necessary, and they're out of the way, they're on their side of the bed and they remain over there. If there's an emergency, you don't have to ask people to move out of the way so you can move the bed or have access to whatever you need. Now, I can tell you that I don't know how many years I have spent many, many nights in the hospital, and I have fabricated things to sleep on, including three straight chairs, my head on one, my hips on one, and so on, and pushed them up close to the bed so I wouldn't fall off. So to provide for a family member to be comfortable and to be there because they recognize when response is needed, quicker than the patient even knows to ask for help.
Have you seen the mock-up room?
Not literally, physically, but I saw the drawing.
Well, you are more than welcome to come, and the rest of you too. Couldn't get you all at one time, but, you know, and I know you, you're more than welcome. We can
bed and lie down and try it out.
Well, yes.
What see you if don't, I can really you, sleep on it.
Well, what we have, remember that patient room, you have first the clinical area, the patient area, and then the family area. In the family area, we're going to have a long stretch couch, basically, that you take the backing off that you'd sit under it, and it is a bed.
And so, what a difference when you think of me sitting in a straight chair with two pillows piled on the foot of the bed and leaning forward.
Yep.
And I can tell you there were numerous times in my husband's care when if I wasn't right there, he would never have left the hospital because you're the first one that knows that someone is needed.
That, and that doesn't surprise me. You know, an individual can sleep in there and be comfortable. And I'd be happy to show any of you that. I'd encourage you to come by sometime. The only problem we're going to have is picking the color of that couch, but it's there and there's plenty of room to sleep on it. But good comments. Thank you. Yes, sir.
What was the reaction or the receptivity of the health insurance companies to your one man, one room concept?
Everybody understand the question? Everybody heard it, right? I think they've gotten used to it now. There are studies that show that less infections are spread through hospitals. In fact, the Institute for American Institute of Architects dealing in healthcare facilities have come out and said that you should have, except if you just absolutely can't afford it, private rooms. But you're right, insurance companies have not, you know, because it's more expensive, more square footage. In fact, it's one of the unintended consequences, perhaps. Nurses are going to have to walk farther. Instead of seeing two patients at one time, they have to walk someplace else. So, you know, there's always some give up as well. But no, they have not hassled us on that. They'll just hassle us on what they're going to pay us, period. You can have any kind of rooms you want. But, you know, actually, we would like to have had more room, but the state more rooms, but the state wouldn't allow that. Because what I'm worried about is that 18 months after we open, we're too small. And that's the history of a lot of hospitals right here in Virginia. And then 18 months later, they're also, you know, recognizing they're too small. And they say, who is that idiot CEO administrator who built a new hospital too small? And they fire them. So I'm worried about that part.
Would you comment, please, on the possibility of national health care and its effect on hospitals the size of Martha Jeff?
Everybody hear the question? The possibility of national health care. You know, I am now 62 years old. When I did a graduate degree at UCLA, and my first day of class, when we walked in as hospital administration, the American Hospital Association had just put out a paper, a position paper on national health insurance, and we were all supposed to comment on it. Of course, we knew nothing then. I don't know why. You know, they asked us to do that. And I guess I've just seen this happen so many times that I don't know. We seem to be close to it. There's 47 million Americans that don't have health insurance, and that's not counting those that are covered, obviously, by Medicaid. So you would think that demand is there, but even on this business about electronic medical records and being moved things back, the debate has already started in the sense, oh, my gosh, that might save some dollars, but it also gets into the privacy issue. And so I don't know what's going to happen and what form it's going to take. I think it's like so many things in America, we wait till it's completely broken and then we fix it. It does seem to me that healthcare is, in its current form, is unsustainable over the long run. And the next economic downturn, and we all know this, is Medicare. Okay? The baby boomer cohort enters the Medicare program in about 2.5 years, 3 years at the most. And when that bulge goes through, and it's because what we can do, we're living longer, and there's so much that we can do on the technology side, the cost side, that that is something that is going to be unbelievably difficult to fix dollar-wise. And so I don't know if it's going to get addressed, and it depends upon the form in which it gets addressed, how it affects Martha Jefferson Hospital. I do think there's some hope in technology, believe it or not, and I used to not talk about it. I think that if you can transport information instantaneously, because people will go to urgent care centers, emergency rooms, their doctors, others, and you go and the doctor doesn't know what tests you have and can't tell, he or she's going to reorder all of those things again, understandably. So there's a lot of waste in that, and you can't move information. Well, we have the technology, but we haven't moved it. The concern is the privacy issue. And I was just thinking about that for myself the other day. How would that work? Could you say, okay, you don't sign up, but maybe you pay more? It's like there are some health plans now saying, okay, if you are way overweight, you're going to pay more on your premium. Or if you smoke, you're going to pay more. I guess there's ways to look at. But we're going to be forced to do something. But I think that there's so much, so many things that have to be taken care of first, like the banking system, that I don't think they're going to get to health care as quickly as they thought. But don't worry, it's going to break down in about 3 or 4 years, and then we'll have to do something.
In regard to the current facility, will there be any possibility of that facility being used to provide primary care or family practice and emergency care in the high-density population area where it exists now? Or is there another location where Martha Jefferson would be able to provide that same service to that high-density population area?
I would very much like to see us provide just what you described, some primary care and emergency facilities or an urgent care center in that area. Part of it will depend upon whoever we finally negotiate with and what they want to do with those facilities. You know, I could see us if, you know, one of the proposals is to keep the main hospital and do rehab. Another proposal is to knock it down. If you were to do the rehab, you could keep the emergency room, which we just remodeled 2 or 3 years ago, in its place and do something else. So the answer is we would very much like to do that. I think we should do that. It's just hard to say. And we have the main corner property, which is about 9 acres, and then our other properties total another 5 acres or so. So within that, there's certainly, be possible to do just what you described. But until we know what someone else comes in, what they want to do, it's hard to kind of describe what we will do.
This is a follow-up on a previously asked question, namely the differentiation between urgent care and emergency. The way I understood your answer is that you discontinued it on Pantops because there was a greater influx of patients needing emergency care, and the other space didn't justify the expense. What I didn't understand is whether in the new facilities you plan again to differentiate between urgent care and emergency, because emergency being the most expensive or one of the most expensive services a hospital renders, it would be cost efficient that if uninsured people don't have to take their children with a rash or a cut or whatever to emergency and burden the already overburdened facility. Do you consider this? And question number two is, do you use solar panels? Not that it would serve all your energy needs, but it would probably, help a little bit and also make a good impression.
Absolutely. Well, your first question, you're absolutely right. As far as an urgent care center, the bill is going to be less than an emergency room. We also recognize that in the Pantops area, there is an urgent care center, First Med. On 29 North, there's prompt care. So it wasn't like we would didn't want any of those to go around anyway. Also, primary care physicians, if you have a primary care physician, he or she should be able to take care of via call and whatever, the more minor types of things. So again, we thought those things were continuing to be provided. When the new hospital is built, I think that you will see us have an urgent care center. I'd love to have one down in the city, but I can't announce that we're going to have one until we know what happens to that building. And if other people put them up and there's not that need, someone else is filling that need, we probably wouldn't do that. But there is that difference. The solar panels, we have spent a lot of time. We've got a small grant from the Kresge Foundation to be a LEED facility. And as you know, there's different levels of LEED, you know, going from, silver all the way to platinum. But it's very, very expensive. But the way we've organized the construction of this hospital, I mean, really, even the way you, the materials you use and the way you dispose of those materials, collect them and get rid of them and so on and so forth. So we're doing as much as we possibly can. We've talked about things like, you know, cogeneration. On one of our roofs, we are designing it so it could be a green roof, but it would be, physically, you've got to put steel and all sorts of things there so it can support a green roof. But right now, so we'd like to add that to the budget, but it's not in the budget. But later on, we could come back and do that. There's all sorts of things that we've talked with GE. We have a special relationship with GE, and I don't mean just its medical equipment. They make light bulbs. They do financing and the like. We've actually gave them the surgical procedure platform that you were mentioning before and said, what do you think, good, bad, or indifferent? And their industrial engineers looked at it and told us they thought this was a marvelous idea because a lot of hospitals don't have what you were describing earlier. So we want to be as green, sustainable as we can. We can't do all the things that we would like to do because it's just a matter of immediate cost. We know that there's payback, so we're looking at some things we can do, some things that we can't. There's actually tiles now instead of solar panels that might work as well that are being tested and looked at. So we're going to do as many of those things as we possibly can. We still have a long way to go. There's lots of things that we can add on as we go, and then later on come back, for instance, on the green roof if there's something left in the budget. But structurally, we'll be able to do that. Did everyone hear the questions? How are we financing a new hospital? And if we sell the existing hospital, how will that go? How will that go back into the new hospital or whatever will happen? There's basically three ways we are doing financing the new hospital. Some of it is through just straight operations. Some of it is clearly through debt financing. We put out $160 million of bonds just when the bond market went crazy, and that was caused us some sleepless nights, but we did get those $160 million bonds, so that's debt. It's like a mortgage to your house. And the other part is philanthropy. So we are raising money. We're out there, and there's somebody in this room that helps us do that, and we appreciate that. And so those are those major ways. We have before we took on this enterprise, we realized that we needed to get some financial altitude because something, as someone described, something will go wrong. Nobody anticipated, quite frankly, that we'd have this economic meltdown worldwide. We thought, well, Medicare will pay us 3% less or something like that. So we ran all these different financial scenarios, and we did fine with those unless four of them all happened at the same time. And this major consideration is, this major problem now is affecting us. But we feel very good about the building the existing hospital where we are on budget. I think the sale of the existing hospital is more challenged because of the economic climate. What we, in this financial plan, we also counted on a certain amount of money from the sale of the existing hospital. But the Board of Trustees went on record. We discussed this. We said we're not just going to sell it to anyone at the highest price, because part of what Martha Jefferson's legacy will be after we move out, 5 years, 10 years later, will be what happens to that piece of property. Is it good for the citizens? Is it good for the neighborhood? Is it good for the city? And so we have decided to stay in it a lot longer. It's another headache we have to deal with. Whereas if we had just sold it and even leased it back, we would have made a lot more money 2 or 3 years ago. But we didn't want to do that because we also liked the idea that if we stayed in it a little bit longer, that two things might happen. Well, one, we'd have some control. I mean, people forget, developers have to make money too. It has to work for them. If we just take everything out of it, they're going to build the cheapest thing, and it won't be very good for anybody. It won't work. So if we don't sell it for the highest price, maybe we can insist that they do something better. If we don't sell it for the highest price, maybe we keep an equity portion of it, and 25 years from now, we get some monies for that. So the next board, the next administration almost has an annuity. That we don't know the answer to just yet. but it's always our intention to take. But on the other hand, we said we just can't give it away either. There has to be some balance here. And so that's the way we were approaching it. Like I said, we haven't really gotten to those negotiations. We wanted to talk to people and find out what they would do. We visited some of the things that they've done elsewhere. Are they good people? Are they likely to be able to do, you know, what they want? We brought an outside firm from Washington, D.C. that wasn't ever going to do any of this to kind of do an economic market analysis so that they could, it wasn't just, you know, Jim Hayden or Mike Matthews or anyone else saying, oh, this is a great piece of property. They could look at it. So we could ask people from the whole region to, you know, here's what someone says about this property. Here's what might be able to be used. A lot of the economic climate has changed since that has been done. So it's not just a matter of those people buying it from Martha Jefferson. Can they do something with it that's nice enough, and can they sell that? Because what they call the absorption rates, people buying, moving in, obviously are a lot slower. So quite frankly, what they would pay us would probably be a fraction of what it cost them to build out over the years. So it's got to work for them as well. Anyway, to answer your question, we want to get some money. The game was never to get as much money and just walk away, and who cares what happens. We care very much what happens. So,
you said the present facility is about 3% completed. What percentage will be necessary to be completed before you move from the present facility over to it? And the second question is, how many rooms or how many patients can you accommodate in the new facility as opposed to the present one?
Both.
Since you can put two in a room and just one in a room over at the new facility.
All right. The first question is how much will we have to have completed before we move over there? This, Ron Cottrell, some of you know him, is actually visiting Rockingham Memorial Hospital today. They are building a new hospital, and they're about a year and a half further along, and it has to do with, you know, the physical moving and their planning of that transition. We have visited two hospitals, the one at Williamsburg, when they moved from an old hospital to a new hospital, just to watch the movement. We had someone from Anne Arundel Hospital in Annapolis come and talk to us about the move and the unexpected things that worked well and what didn't work well. We will be pretty well along before we move, but we will move the IT, information technology, the computer room people first. They may get there as much as 8 or 9 months before anyone else gets there. And they will actually run all our IT stuff at the main hospital from the new campus. Because what you don't want to do is have people walk in and have a lot of nice new systems that they're not used to. And because so much now is carried over the IT lines, not just, you know, financial data, but medical data coming from the CT scanners and the MRs and the ultrasounds and the digital mammography units, that has to work real well. So they'll be the first people out there. And they could be out there 6 to 9 months before anyone else, working out all the things that need to be worked out. The hospital will be finished. Whenever it's finished, it'll be finished, and then there'll be about a good 4 months before we actually move in, because we will send teams of nurses out there, teams of all sorts of different people to, if you will, practice and dry run, because they're in a different building. And what was described before, and we're so excited about this new platform, it's different. So you don't want them to have patients all of a sudden to go out there. The platform might be great, it might be better, but if they don't know how to use it, that's not going to be helpful. So we will have a 4-month practice period for lots of doctors and nurses and all sorts of, you know, physical therapists and you know, you name it out there, and then we will move. Which gets us to the question, when will we move? We've been saying 2012. The booklet that I passed out says, you know, 2012, and it all depends upon this winter and the next winter. If we have an easy winter this winter and we have an easy winter next winter, we will get there perhaps as early as the fall of 2011. If we have one winter that's really bad and we can't encase the building, then we'll probably be there in the spring of 2012 or even the summer. What was your second question? Oh, the number of patients. We are licensed now for 176 beds. You know, roughly 50% of those are semi-privates. In the new hospital, we'll have 176 beds,
We had to go back to the state because they only want us to have 152 beds. Actually, we think we need more, but 176 beds will, in fact, give us more capacity for patients. And let me tell you why. Because currently today, if we have a semi-private room and you have a patient with an infection, we can't put someone else in that same room. You know, so we don't have the capacity there. If you have a male in that room and you need a bed for a female, you can't put a female in that room. You can't put what they call a clean case and a dirty case. But by having 176 individual separate beds, it does actually give us more capacity than we have today. Having said that, I'm not sure it's going to be enough. But that's all we can get in. There's a process in the state, and there's a good reason for that process. Part of it is it works. Part of it doesn't work. So much of what happens in a hospital today uses a hospital bed, but it's not counted as an inpatient. In other words, for instance, I had a cardiac cath in Martha Jefferson Hospital, so I have the cath in the morning. I'm in a bed for 4 hours. Well, that doesn't count, quite frank. Just they're watching me. They're monitoring me after this cardiac catheterization, and I'm sent home. Well, probably somebody had a cardiac cath around noon and went back into that bed, after it was clean, that room was clean, and is in that bed and went home at 8 or 9 in the evening. That does not, that bed is occupied. We can't put anyone in there. But when the state looks at that, because someone didn't stay overnight, not 24 hours, it's not counted as, occupied. So you're, to increase the number of beds, you have to show a certain occupancy. And the way hospitals work nowadays, the way medicine is delivered, people come in for 23 hours or 4 hours. So a bed is taken, but it doesn't count as a overnight stay, and it's hard to get additional beds. So we'll have more beds than we have today. I do worry 18 months after we open, we go, oh, my gosh, we wish we had another wing.
Jim, could you comment on the attraction of this new hospital of bringing some of the best physicians in the country? And not only Charlottesville does this, but Martha Jefferson will. And the second question is, in two and a half years, Medicare is going to have some problems.
Yep.
What does this mean about consolidation of other hospitals and outpatient clinics in other places?
Wow.
And, where do we go from here?
Yeah, good questions. Well, first, I want to thank John Henricks, like several other of you who I look around and see who have helped Martha Jefferson in innumerable ways. And so I take this opportunity to thank you, John, for showing up on Saturdays and bringing people to Martha Jefferson so we can explain what we're doing and so on and so forth, giving us comments that help make us better. The first question had to do the attractiveness of the new facility. And again, if you remember, I started my remarks that saying that this new hospital is going to have a great site. It's going to have great views. It's going to have state-of-the-art facilities. But the most important thing, clearly, is what happens inside. And to the extent that you need physical facilities to do it, the miracles that doctors can do with the help of nurses and ancillaries, we need more space. So that's clear and needed and good. But we have been very fortunate over the last 4, 5, 6 years in physicians who have come to Martha Jefferson Hospital. For those of you who don't know, John's son, a very highly specialized dermatologist called a Mohs surgeon, came to our hospital from the University of Virginia Medical Center. And we have added that. And since then, another physician, a Mohs surgeon, has joined our staff at Martha Jefferson Hospital. John's daughter-in-law is a radiation oncologist in cancer. And she and her teammate, if you will, our physician, Dr. Sylvia, not Sylvia Henricks, but Dr. Cindy Spaulding, do a terrific job of that clinical care, high clinical care with highly personalized delivery. So we've always been lucky to have individuals like that on our staff. But over the last 3 or 4 years, we have brought people on, and part of it, I think, is showing them the strategic plan, showing where we're going to be. There's a vascular surgeon we have by the name of John Ligish. I know we brought him here, and it was Dr. Lewis Owens. Dr. Owens said, Jim, Latham Murray and I are getting so busy in the vascular surgery area, we really need to get someone else. We really need to get someone good. And I said, well, you must know who's good. And he said, well, there's this fellow down at Baptist Hospital, part of the Wake Forest system. He's the number 2 vascular surgeon down there, does 400 cases a year. And, you know, the number one guys who sit out there raising money and talking. They don't do any real work. And but John Ligish does. And he's been in academic medical medicine. He's written all the papers you're supposed to write. But he's been there about 8 or 9 years. So he's thinking, you know, like, as most, should I stay in academic medicine or should I go to a community hospital and, you know, do that? And I said, well, why don't we invite him? And Lewis says, oh, I don't know. I don't think we could get John Ligish to come here. So, well, why don't we invite him and tell him, ask him who he thinks, you know, some of his better residents and fellows are or coming up and so on and so forth. Maybe we can get them, have him help us design a vascular surgery department and service. So John comes up, and the outpatient care center wasn't built, but we took him to the site. We showed him our plans. Here's what we're going to do. He met with a radiologist. He met with others, the surgeons, some board members. And guess what? John Ligish came. And a very famous surgeon at the university, I won't say his name, but said to me, when he bumped into me, how did you get John Ligish to come to Martha Jefferson? And I said, you know what? We're allowed to get great doctors, too. We're allowed to get great doctors. And more recently, and I'm jumping around because we have so many good ones. This retina surgeon is absolutely fabulous. But more recently in cardiology, we got a fellow from the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. John Zacabe. John is an electrophysiologist. He puts in pacemakers and defibrillators and does what they call ablation, you know, 4 or 5 procedures. When those things don't work, medicines don't work, to change the rhythm of the heart. I mean, this is really high, high end. And he came from the Cleveland Clinic, which is arguably, as training grounds for cardiologists, a place that, you know, everybody in this country would say, wow, you're lucky to get somebody like that. So Tim Williams, a general cardiologist, says, oh, gee, John now, John Zacabe is at the Cleveland Clinic. You know, he's going to graduate. He's going to finish his fellowship. And why don't we invite him down here? And again, didn't think, well, might not be able to get him. But, you know, his credentials are great. The Cleveland Clinic, he was chief resident. They wanted to keep him there at the Cleveland Clinic. He was offered a job someplace else. But we got him to come down, talk to us, and I can remember very, very distinctly, I'm in the room, 2 board members, my colleague Elliot Quita, and, you know, again, his resume is just fabulous. And talking to him, he's just a wonderful person. So he leaves the room, and one of the board members, you know, says, oh, gosh, you know, he's a Martha Jefferson-type doctor as well as a good guy. But we'll never get him. Well, you know, John, guess what? John Zacabe is here. We thought he'd do 30 ablations in his first year. He's been here less than 5 months, and he's done 22 of these already, and he's absolutely terrific. So we have been able to attract, I think, wonderful physicians. And those are just 2 examples. To join the medical staff at Martha Jefferson Hospital. When I came, we had 143 physicians. We have over 400 on our staff now. They come from all the medical schools in the country, which I think it's good to have diversity and different opinions and different training programs, you know, chipping in. So I think that has been, will the new building help? Sure. It'll help with nurses. It'll help with everybody. But we're proud of who we have and where we're going. The second question, John, now that I blabbed on, what was that? This is a $64,000 question. I'm surprised I'm getting it, but now that I have it, I'll have to answer it, I guess. The question is, because of the Medicare situation, they're going to pay all hospitals less, they're going to pay doctors less. I mean, it's scary. There's more needs by Medicare patient. Medicare, its absolute budget is going up, but they pay doctors less, and it's hard for doctors to make it on Medicare. So it's really a catch-22. Same thing for hospitals. And with this tremendous deficit we have, we know Martha Jefferson, along with other hospitals, we're going to get paid less. It's going to happen. It's not going to be very pleasant. How do we deal with that? There has been tremendous consolidation across this country. Not so much, you know, Martha Jefferson's a freestanding community hospital. You have Winchester, which is a Valley Health System, but they have, you know, have some small hospitals and a major hospital up in Winchester. And then you have Rockingham Hospital, and you have Augusta, and you have us. So the Shenandoah Valley, quite frankly, there are very few standalone community hospitals left in Virginia, or quite frankly, except in very, very rural areas in the United States. I've seen the numbers. There's just been more and more consolidation. North Carolina is almost completely consolidated. There's a hospital system that you probably all saw where a University of Virginia has bought into Culpeper Hospital. They bought 49% of Culpeper and is going, you know. And so I think you're going to see the big hospitals go to the smaller hospitals and partner up with them. I know that I have received calls and visits unsolicited from large for-profit systems to colleagues in small systems. Just yesterday, I got offered to talk with three or four other hospitals. Maybe we ought to get together and do something. And what that means can be a whole host of things. For instance, we have a partnership with five other hospitals for purchasing. By getting together and purchasing together, it drives the cost down. And we save $500,000 or $600,000 a year on that. That's nice. That's good. It may not be enough. We have an insurance captive with five or six other hospitals, and the same thing is true. Part of the question is, will we continue to do those sort of things, and do we have 45 of those, or do you do something with a large system? The Obesey Hospital, Williamsburg Hospital went with Sentara. Again, these were very, very friendly. This is what these hospitals wanted to do. And the Williamsburg Hospital, by just going with this large hospital system, saved $2 million in purchasing just overnight because the large system can demand better pricing. So there's going to be a lot of pressure to look at that and talk about that and do that. Prince William Hospital up in Manassas, you may have read this in the paper, wanted to merge with the Innova Health System, who took over Loudoun Hospital several years ago. And when I say take over, these are friendly, joining of organizations together. And so I called. Mike Schwartz is the CEO of Prince William. And I said, Mike, looks like financially you're doing pretty well, and I'm surprised that you're doing this. And he said, well, Jim, we looked forward. We looked 5 or 6 years ahead, and would we be able to afford all the CTs, MRs, IT, physician consolidation that is going on? And we said, we don't think so. He said, that was on the positive side. He said, on the negative side, and if we didn't do that, Innova was going to come down here, build a big facility anyway. So they signed up to go with Innova, and Innova pledged to put in $200 million over 10 years. And they thought that was a pretty good. So they were happy with that. However, the Justice Department stopped them from doing that. They thought it was too much consolidation, almost monopoly in a certain area. So, John, you're going to see a lot more of that. We're not immune to that. One of our physicians asked me if I would talk to a physician in Richmond. So I said, sure, I'm thinking this physician's going to visit me and talk to me about coming to perhaps Martha Jefferson Hospital, setting up practice and so on and so forth. This physician and three other people walk in, and wouldn't you know it, was someone from HCA, Health Corporation of America, because they're very dominant in Richmond. And they said, gee, wouldn't you like to do something with us? I said, well, let me think about that, and that was a couple of years ago. But that will continue, and I think the pressure will get greater and greater. It's going to get greater on physicians. I think you'll see more and more physicians who are private practitioners wish to be employed. I mean, that's clear, and I am going to stop now. So that question is still to be answered, but it's very much a very real question. All right, thank you all very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.